So without further ado, I would like to welcome Dr. Jim Kelly.
Thank you.
Who will talk to you about this.
I'll just give you some, explain what's happening tonight. There's a UK-wide festival of the humanities called Being Human, and it's a chance for universities across the land, really, to engage with the public and just give them a snapshot of what kind of research we do. Because sometimes the concept of research in English may not be as transparent as the concept of research in medicine, for instance. So we're not exactly developing new drugs up on the hill in Penryn, in the University of Exeter, but we are developing sometimes new readings, or we're thinking about how traditional culture, folk culture, informs the present day. So this came about, the reason I wanted to do this was, you may have picked, I'm not from Cornwall, okay, but you may have guessed that. I came over to Cornwall and I discovered a poet called Charles Causley, who I hadn't really read before coming here. And I found these great resonances in his poetry with an Irish poet called Louis MacNeice, who was part of the 1930s generation with W.H. Auden and poets like that. And I started thinking about Causley, and what I found fascinating about him was his use of the ballad form in his poetry, and his interest in ghost story and gothic tales. And so I thought, I'm going to write a paper about this guy, I think he's fantastic. So I called it Causley's Haunted Launceston, because I didn't come from Cornwall, and I didn't know that his town is pronounced Lanston. So I thought I had stumbled on this lovely haw sound, Haunted Launceston. But someone quickly corrected me on that. But it turned out, I think, to be quite a felicitous correction, because you're reading Causley an awful lot of the time, and he seems to be doing very traditional ballad forms, four-beat lines. You probably will have Jim singing a few of his songs. But he occasionally throws it off. He throws off his sound scheme. He throws off his meter. And he occasionally will tell traditional ballad stories, murders, betrayals, ghost stories. But he'll tweak it to be a little bit more psychological, maybe, a little bit more modern. And I thought about ways in which we interact with folk traditions or traditional culture. And I thought, well, you know, colleagues such as Professor Nick Groom, Professor Marion Gibson, very interested in this topic. My colleague, Dr. Rob Smith, who's a novelist, is very interested in kind of this idea of the dark side of folk tradition. We have a great tradition of, sometimes it's called folk horror in Britain and Ireland. Films like The Wicker Man, which is set in set based on a 1963, I think it's 63 novel, Ritual, which is set in Cornwall, actually, in the film. It's set up in the Summer Isles in Scotland. And I thought, let's do something with all these interests we have. And I thought this would be a fantastic location, and it is an amazing location. I came to Helston Museum about a year and a half ago on the recommendation of Rob, and I much like those of you who haven't been here before, you just keep on walking and walking and walking, and there's always something to see, and it's an incredibly inspiring location, I think, a location which just has so many stories behind each of the objects here. So I thought we'll do an event, and then I'd heard Jim Causley, the singer, had put some of Charles Causley's poems to music, and I thought, well, let's get him to perform as well. Because I don't want it just to be me or Nick or Marion or Rob talking. I want there to be some music. I'm hoping some of you may have brought instruments with you. If we have time at the end, we can have a little bit of a folk session. Let's see what happens. And let's just make it a bit of a celebration of all those things that we tie us to the past. As I say, I'm coming from Ireland, I'm coming from a different region, culture, nation, and yet I find there are these echoes, resonances, particularly when I come to Cornwall, that made me want to just investigate this and make sure that I had people outside of academia who could maybe give me some feedback, tell me some stories, that kind of thing. So I'm going to stick with the name Causley's Haunted Launceston. And again, apologies for mispronouncing that. And thinking about Gothic childhood, Causley in an interview, he died in 2003, but an interview in 1988, he talked about his reputation as a children's poet, as a poet for children, and his folk tradition, his kind of sense of, you know, the poems of folklore. And I read some reviews of Crosley, and one critic called Robert Shaw wrote that on his first reading of Crosley's poems of childhood and the Navy, and the folklorish poems, you know, there was a sense that Crosley's reputation was built on folklore and children's lit. But I think there is a way in that children's literature and folklore are intimately connected. In an interview, as I say, with Brian Merrick, he said, children know all about betrayal, seduction. This is the first quote on that handout that's going around. Sudden death, marital infidelity, murder, and God knows what. And they simply lapped up these ballads. He's talking about going into schools and singing his ballads to children. I don't know how much children know about betrayal, seduction, sudden death, marital infidelity, murder, and God knows what. But we'll go with Crosley on this. I discovered that young people were a kind of medieval people. For this reason, whenever we did a Christmas play, I always tried to do the medieval plays from the mysteries. They seemed to understand what was going on the surface and underneath the poems as well. That was how I started on a very long road of discovery as to how or what one should offer to children. I think the term Gothic itself comes from medieval culture. It was initially used to describe the type of Gothic architecture that you see in old ruined cathedrals, or neo-Gothic, I suppose, 19th century revival Gothic in Truro. And the architectural legacies of castles and churches, I think, weighs quite heavily on Crosley and on the town of Lanson. And I think if you went around here, this kind of arched doorway that we all walked through is a callback to a type of Gothic architecture as well. But I'm interested in these kind of extreme literary states, these tales about murder, betrayal, ballads. I have a very dark side. Don't let the waistcoat and tie fool you. I'm a deviant. But the role of Gothic in children's literature in particular interested me. I think we maybe take it for granted in our post-Twilight, post-Stephanie Myers. I'm not going to pretend to know all that stuff. We take it for granted that children's literature is attracted to the darkness, to the dark side, to vampires, werewolves, and ghosts. And I think gradually, certainly as an academic, there's a lot of academics who are working on the connections between Gothic literature and childhood. Because children are uncanny. Children are Gothic in their own right. Children are incredibly uncanny, and they're used brilliantly. If you think of films like The Village of the Damned, all those children just kind of staring at you with their bright eyes and their blonde hair. There are two ways, according to a critic called Stephen Broom, there's two ways of approaching children. One is the sentimental and one is the Gothic. This is the second quote here. We only have two genres available to us where children are concerned, the sentimental and the Gothic. And what's more important, these two genres are much the same thing. He's quoting someone else there. For wherever there is a child to be adored or nurtured, there is also a child to be threatened, violated, and killed. There's a horror film just now, actually, called The Hallow, which is about an English couple who go to Ireland, and their child comes under threat from fairies in the forest. Right, it's a bit cheesy, but there is something that provokes fear and anxiety in adults when it comes to children. I often say the best example of this, of the uncanny child, is a Pixar film from a few years ago called Monsters Inc., where the joke is that the monsters are terrified of children. Because children are, of course, terrified of monsters, and children are terrified of adults. But what isn't often recognised is that there is a certain fear of children as well. I'm not saying I'm terrified of children, by the way. I won't scream like a child if one comes in. But childhood is a precarious balance, I think, between innocence and trauma. And I think once Jim starts singing some of the Crosley ballads, you'll probably hear an element of this when he's singing about Tim Winters or when he's singing about childhood literature. There is a precarious balance between innocence and trauma, and the child itself can be a slightly unusual, an uncanny presence. There's a poem called Innocence Song, the Song of the Innocents by Crosley, which brilliantly ratchets up uncanny images. It's ostensibly about a child's questions about Christmas. Who's that knocking on the window? Who's that standing at the door? What are all those presents lying on the kitchen floor? There's a gradual accumulation of slightly uncanny versions of traditional Christmas images, but it culminates in the answer, Herod. It's not Santa, it's Herod. It's the Father Christmas. Sorry, it's Herod. I mean, what a brutal way to end a very simple poem. About Christmas. Oh yes, that Herod, that happened. Deceptively simple poems like this, I think, in Cawsley, serve as examples of this sort of uncanny quality. The awareness of the vulnerability of innocence, the cheerful red of Christmas here retrospectively transformed into the spilled blood of children. The tone will get lighter, by the way. We're starting low and we're working up, okay, so there will be some laughs later. Cawsley's childhood, this is the American poet critic, Dana Joy. Cawsley's childhood, which was much harsher and more painful, he lost his father at quite an early age, often serves as a sacramental presence in his work. He presents no distinct adult persona, no cagey university librarian such as Philip Larkin, or sharp-clawed literary lion such as T.S. Eliot, maybe. Separate from the Cornish schoolboy who has matured seamlessly into a successful writer. And yet, if Cawsley's innocence is tangible in the poetry, it has been tempered by hard experience of death, war, and suffering. Cawsley served in the Navy. His father was in the First World War. There's a constant sense of that trauma of the wider world. And as I say, in many ways he can be compared to the Irish poet Louis MacNeice. He's a wonderful poet that I'd encourage you to chase up. A poet that Cawsley had read and absorbed, and indeed his first collection has a poem called Homage to Louis MacNeice. MacNeice's childhood was spent in a small town called Carrickfergus, which actually is quite similar to Launceston, I think. There's a castle. It's a bit of a distance away from the main kind of urban centre of Belfast. He lost his mother when he was a child, so Cawsley lost his father, MacNeice lost his mother. And MacNeice's childhood was interrupted by war. Indeed, MacNeice's whole life was interrupted by war. There's a wonderful poem called Carrickfergus, which kind of details, which would, if you just change the title, I think it could be called Lanson. But it might be MacNeice's short poem Autobiography from 1940 that more closely resembles a sort of antecedent, I think, for Cawsley. In my childhood, trees were green and there was plenty to be seen. Come back early or never come. A very simple, simple little rhythm there, right? When I was five, the black dreams came. Nothing after was quite the same. Come back early or never come. Using a very simple beat, a very simple rhythm, observable from nursery rhymes, from ballads, to get a very dark psychological, sort of autobiographical presentation. Children haunt Cawsley, I think, but they are also haunted. And his deceptively simple poem, and I keep on using this phrase, deceptively simple poetry, often is tackling the inability to access a lost childhood. This is from a poem called Who? And I think it's the fourth quote on the handout. Why does he move like a wraith by the water, soft as the thistle down on the breeze blowing? When I draw near him so that I may hear him, why does he say that his name is my own? And then we can move on to another poem, which is the fifth quote. And this is a wonderful poem by St. Thomas Water. And it's sort of recounting one of these sort of folk beliefs, right? That if you walk around a grave a couple of times, seven, three times, five times, different versions change, you'll hear the dead speak. You know, a wonderfully kind of ghostly image. If we walk, said Jesse, seven times round, we shall hear a dead man speaking underground. Round the stone we danced, we sang, watched the sun drop, laid our heads and listened at the tomb top. Soft as the thunder at the storm's start, I heard a voice as clear as blood, strong as the heart. I can never say, I shook my fingers round my head, drove them away. That shutting the fingers around the head, not around the ears, but around the head. I mean, where is this sound coming from in Cawsley? And that's what I'm always wondering. We're not dealing with ghosts here. Or we might be, but they're ghosts which have a sort of a psychological existence, and a slightly troubling existence as well. It really will get lighter, by the way. Don't worry. I had a version of this paper with jokes. I'll put it that way. Said, no, stick to the normal stuff. Cawsley corresponded with another poet in Cornwall called W.S. Graham. And Graham was originally from Greenock in Scotland, in Glasgow. I did my PhD in Edinburgh, so I've got lots of fondness for Scotland, and indeed I'm going there tomorrow. And Graham is more typically what you might expect from a modernist poet. There's a terrible sense nowadays that poetry is a bit difficult, and it's a bit inaccessible, and it is asking you to do difficult things when you're reading it. And it goes back to sort of T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland, modernist poetry in the 1920s. And Graham is a great poet, but there is an edge to him. It's a little bit more tricky, maybe, to read a Graham poem than a Cawsley poem. But Graham usually sometimes uses this sort of nice little nursery rhyme ballad four-beat meter, okay, or kind of measure, if you like. And he wrote a letter to Cawsley, which I've quoted at some length here on the handout, because it's an interesting kind of meditation by a poet on the process of using a traditional form, such as a ballad. To write a contemporary poem consciously using the nostalgia of form, which is not possible now to use in the way for which the form came about, is exciting. I think there must be quite an extensive technical area to be explored in that direction, but it must be more than just your own contemporary poetic experience expressed in the characteristic ballad voice. The performer playing the Green King of the Wood, and I have a feeling Nick or Marion could fill us in on who the Green King of the Wood is in more detail than I could, must never for an instant let the audience get the idea that he thinks he really is the king. The disguise he uses to play the king must just be merely held before him, formal and apparent. In my own ballads, one of the ways I attempted this was to lean around the disguise and grimace and speak personally to the... Oh, I've done that. Academics always do that when we have quotation marks. Apologies. I should cut my fingers off. Speak personally to the reader so that we became two intelligences or characters taking part in the action of the ballad. And as a device, that is as contrary as it could be to that particular gesture the ballad originally evolved for. There's a lot going on in this statement, in this letter to Cawsley, I think. A sense that a modern poet has to be slightly ironic, has to approach the ballad form with a sense of pretense, kind of poking around and winking at the audience. And that is not something in the ballad, or that's not what the ballad evolved for. As a device that is as contrary as it could be to the particular gesture the ballad originally evolved for. I think we might disagree with W.S. Graham, and it would be interesting to hear the views of Jim and other singers, if any of you are singers or interested in ballad form, whether the ballad is a sort of naive, innocent form, or whether there is a sort of element of winking at the audience involved in it. But I think Cawsley is not simply... You know, I think Cawsley has an element where he does sort of acknowledge the form he's using. And he does sort of change it a little bit. He makes it a little bit more ironic, a little bit more modern. So that even though he's very different, I think most people who read Cawsley and then read W.S. Graham would say they're polar opposites. You know, W.S. Graham, a great modernist, postmodernist in some ways, poet interested in language and difficulty. I think there's less clear blue water between these two wonderful poets based down here in Cornwall than may be indicated. And I want to finish with this, an excerpt from a poem of Cawsley's called A Local Haunting, which is about a ghost up in Boscastle. Is it Boscastle? It is Boscastle off the top of my head. About a child who's haunted by a female ghost. And there is obviously a story behind this. But Cawsley ratchets it up into something perhaps a little bit more post-Freudian, a little bit more modern. And it's about speaking to the child and not really understanding what the ghost is saying. So if you think back to that by St. Thomas Water, what words were spoken I can never say, right? I shut the fingers around my head. It's almost echoed in this quote. It is actually echoed in this quotation. What were the words she tried in vain to speak to a child's unbruised heart? The priest in his confessor's head kept her slow stain of speech apart. Kept her slow stain of speech apart. If you're listening to that, if you've got an ear for poetry, you can just hear that there's a disturbance in the meter there. The priest in his confessor's head kept her slow stain of speech apart. Yet all his life, with stiffening brow, he waited for the ghost's return, paced the untenanted field, afraid, alone, abstracted. He would burn with love for the bitch of a shade, attend her voice, as I do now. Two very powerful closing lines there, disturbing closing lines. Indeed, the bitch of a shade is a very disturbing way to refer to a female ghost, or any female. But, you know, it, why this choice of words? And then that final invocation, or final apostrophe, as we say, address to the reader, attend her voice as I do now. He always brings it back to an interiority, a sort of psychological interiority, a self, I think, which is questioning this supernatural encounter. And it makes for a poetry which is on the surface wonderful, and it's a terrible shame that calls these collected poems has gone out of print temporarily. I'm hoping it comes back in, because he is someone who deserves a lot more attention than he gets. But it comes back to him. This simple poetry, this childlike poetry occasionally, throws in something, maybe an odd bit of meter, maybe an odd word, that just shocks the audience a little bit, throws them off guide. And I think that's the essence of the uncanny, the unheimlich, the thing that disturbs us.